You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you with us today as we visit with our guest, Kelly Norris. He's an experienced plantsman, author of the award-winning book, New Naturalism. We'll talk with him about using nature as a template for your garden design. And love to have you join in. Would you like to have your landscape to be more based on nature? Do you have questions about selecting plants? We'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Kelly Norris, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
So we talked to you last year when your book, New Naturalism, Designing and Planting a Resilient, Ecologically Vibrant Home Garden, that's the whole title, when it came out. For those who missed it, tell us about the concept.
Well, you know, New Naturalism is somewhat pervasive idea right now in gardening, as we're becoming, from I think many sources of inspiration, aware that our gardens are not separate from the world around us, that we're connected to the ecology of place by plants that we might grow in our gardens that have been native here for quite a long time, that support a whole array of creatures and organisms that we share our garden with. And I think we're also being inspired by designers and artists around the world who are making looser, more naturalistic gardens that channel our emotions for wild places. And so New Naturalism sort of takes all that in summary and writes a letter of sorts to a gardener at home wondering about how they can do more of this.
Yeah. So what do you see as the advantages of designing this way?
Well, the title includes the word resiliency, which I use really more so today than I use the word sustainable. I always kind of say, you know, sustainable, anything is sustainable with the right amount of resources, but it's the resource limitations that are challenging in the world today, whether that's water or time or money or what have you. So we need to create gardens that have a life of their own in some ways, that are kind of little systems, little engines of life that keep on living. We may get to call the balls and the strikes and get to be the referee from time to time, but it's a more resource-conscious mindset about how we make gardens that are literally and figuratively rooted in place.
Yeah, and how's the plant community reacted to these principles?
Well, I think there are more native plants today, Larry, available to the average home gardener than there ever have been. I would go one step further and say I think there's more plant diversity available to gardeners today than there probably ever has been. And you know, plant diversity is kind of the foundational element here. When we plant diverse gardens, we know from research that they're going to support diverse amounts of life. And so I think in some ways, actually, it's creating a new renaissance, a new time in gardening that allows us to rethink our plantings and what we're doing.
You have a new business. It's called the Public Horticulture Company. Tell us about your business.
Well, since we last spoke, you know, I've been in private practice as a planting designer and artist now for some time. But the new venture is putting the third leg on the stool a little bit. You know, I'm often asked and often work in public spaces. I'm passionate about reconceiving the horticultural experience of our cities, whether that's in schools and college campuses or corporate, you know, office campuses or what have you. I'm interested in public horticulture with a capital P and a capital H. And so often I create these projects, but there are not often the kinds of landscape management services available to be good stewards of them. So we decided to take a leap and offer those stewardship services. And so we've begun that work here in central Iowa, and we really think the concept has some legs. It could really be something that is of value to cities everywhere, frankly, in offering an ecologically driven knowledge and research-based approach to managing landscapes as a, you know, as opposed to just simply being obsessed with their cosmetics.
Does the management of these landscapes become simpler under the new naturalism?
Well, I think it certainly becomes more maybe results-oriented. I mean, I never like to criticize my colleagues, but sometimes the work that we do in traditional landscape maintenance is not often directed towards the result. It's about the practice. It's about the fussing and not really about what the fussing's for. So, you know, we like to think that in the end, it actually is a more resource-conscious way of keeping landscapes. Knowledge costs more. It's a more premium service. It has a lot of value associated with it. But the trade-off is it pays off in the long run. You end up investing in the success of projects and not simply trying to, you know, mitigate their depreciation. We're trying to keep landscapes alive and living for a long time.
Wondering about thinking about just businesses as opposed to government. I'm thinking here in Wisconsin, there's a Madison business, American Family Insurance. Actually, it's a national business,
yes,
but its home offices are here. And I think they've done a lot in this area. I'm not sure if you're familiar with American Family and what they've done, but their prairie and their work to make their landscape more natural, I think it's been very well received.
Well, I am familiar certainly with the company and some of the work that they've done in the philanthropic work they've done in the Madison area to support, you know, places like Olbrich Botanical Garden and what have you. But I think you make a good point that it you know, sometimes we look to the business community sometimes for leadership on these things because, of course, they're an insurance company. Their job is to, you know, take care of people and those sorts of things. And so obviously they need to be able to run their office campuses and their places of doing business in an efficient way. And so, you know, when companies start to make these kinds of investments, it sometimes has the sort of feedback loop of making us rethink in both governmental and other organizational settings. You know, why are we spending all this money, you know, year after year, season on season, to sort of keep up a landscape that maybe its only purpose is cosmetic? Why not create something that supports the ecosystem, that supports our, you know, our right to a healthy and a beautiful landscape to live and work in?
So what are the benefits of a more natural, let's think about this a more natural landscape to the community as a whole in your mind?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, you know, I think the benefits are there's many of them. I think one, I mean, we know that we're not alone in this world. Pollinators, if we were to focus on the insect value alone, you know, support huge numbers of agronomic systems, foods we go to the grocery store and buy, you know. And so I think that there's that sense that, you know, we're not in this alone, that there is a sort of communal aspect to things. And of course, that just has implications up the food chain. You know, in our own garden here at home in Des Moines, you know, a little more than a half an acre that we've taken to, you know, committed to this ecological journey on, just 5 years in from the first planting, we've observed 15 species of migratory warblers in both the fall and spring seasons. The amount of life that can come from these plantings in a seemingly short period of time is gratifying, but I think also underscores just how impactful this can be for a home gardener. And why would we not want to sort of live in an abundant world with these forms of life? I mean, for ourselves, for our kids, for the safety and the sanctity of the planet.
Yeah. Well, and thinking about homeowners, what should a homeowner think about when designing a garden based on nature? How do you have to approach that?
I that's a great question. I think one of the first things that I always tell people is that, you know, your garden may not be that so far off. It's easy to sort of think as gardeners that we're always up to doing something wrong and that there's something more we can learn about it. And we can always learn more. But I would say most people may, you know, if they take an honest look at their garden, may realize, you know, I've got some native plants out there already. I mean, native, you know, where plants come from, it doesn't exclusively predict what ecosystem or ecological services they have. So it's fair to look at your garden with open eyes. But my motto is to just keep planting. It's, the thing we love to do as gardeners is go buy more plants. So, you know, as we plant more densely and more diversely, creating essentially more complex gardens, it's those complex habitats of sorts that give the garden or make the garden a home for so many of the creatures. So I tell people to just keep planting, because, you know, and plant with, a sort of place in mind. Wisconsin is a beautiful place, or Northern Illinois, or wherever folks are listening from today. We have great, fascinating, wonderful plants in our local flora that we should appreciate and that should call our gardens home.
Kelly Norris, our guest, an award-winning author and plantsman and the former director of horticulture and education at the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden in Iowa, as we talk with him about designing with nature in mind. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments about your area. What have you been doing? What questions you have about plants or design, perhaps? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening to this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kelly Norris. His book on new naturalism in your garden and in your landscape has been very well received. And he's an award-winning author. And, of course, he works daily in the entire business of designing with nature in mind. Questions for him, again, you can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Cheryl in Watertown, we'll go to you now. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. I'm actually very intrigued by this, Kelly, because we, my husband and I purchased a home with a couple acres, and he's very traditional gardener, if you will, and I'm really wanting to turn a part of our property into more of what you were speaking about, which about a half acre of prairie land. So where do you start with something like that? And how do you convince somebody that's very traditional to stop having a manicured lawn and traditional flowers?
Well, you sound like about half of my residential clients. There's usually one partner that's always very keen on this and one I usually have to persuade. In fact, this morning I was on site at a residential project where almost exactly that setup was the case. And the partner that was not as enthusiastic last year said to me first out the gate, he goes, "This isn't at all what I expected, and that's a good thing." And so, I think one of the things that we do in our practice, Cheryl, to take that into account is in some ways, all the rules of traditional design, color, texture, form, seasonal interest, all these things are in some ways as relevant as ever. I mean, this isn't just some scattershot approach in which we're just casting seeds around and, hoping for the best. It's not, total random chaos. In fact, it's actually in some ways quite patterned. It's quite complex. It's quite layered. We're thinking about, is there always color in the garden? There's been research that shows that people's response to these kinds of gardens changes when they see something like 27% of the square footage of the planting in flower or in color at any given point in time. So we use kind of research-based methods like this to know that, people like color, people like flowers. Pollinators like flowers too. So, I mean, we always want to make sure that there's ways to, bring all those important principles into the garden. I also find, too, that in general, some people are actually surprised, not that we spend a lot of time, checking plants' papers at the gate, so to speak. I mean, we garden principally with plants that are, you know, predominantly native to the places that we work. But I often find that people sometimes don't really know what is and isn't native. And in fact, things that might have been traditionally, so to speak, used in gardens that are native, say like various rudbeckias or black-eyed Susans, are suddenly quite palatable to people when they realize, oh, well, that's something that's, you know, already useful and beneficial and part of the ecosystem. So some of it's education, some of it's, you know, bringing to the fore those values that people, you know, still want to hold on to. The lawn thing is a bit, you know, is a bit tricky because that is a completely social construct. So that gets into a level of sociology that sometimes I feel underqualified to address. But we understand the value, of course, of, you know, having well cared for turf that a kid can kick a ball around in and you can have a picnic on. Our goal is to maybe just minimize that footprint from where we often start, because oftentimes we have way more turf than what we actually use or really need.
So where does Cheryl start? Well, she could take a look at your book, for one thing.
Well, I suppose that's true. There is that. I think one of the things that people often use my book for is, you know, in Cheryl's case, is to take that to the dining room table and sort of go, look at how beautiful these things can be. I mean, that, you know, it's not as if we're trying to, you know, put the tallgrass prairie exactly into your front lawn, although a half an acre is not a small project. So certainly, you know, there's probably a factor of wildness that comes into that, you know, is part of the nature of the project. But I think, you know, starting with, you know, precedents that show people, go to my Instagram, which is just my whole name, Kelly D. Norris on Instagram, and you can see, you know, pretty weekly, you know, examples of projects that are quite beautiful, that are done in this way and that people get very excited about.
Cheryl, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I hope that helped. Let's go to Angela in Fish Creek. It's your turn, Angela. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. We actually have been doing this for years. We have just over an acre, and we have lots of our yard that is not mowed. And so we have some natural prairie spaces, but a lot of it is tall grass. And we recently, thanks to the Door County Seed Library, were able to get quite a few native seed packets to be able to start to bring in some more diversity to the space that we've already let, you know, maintain some of its naturalness. But I'm curious what the best way is to start those seeds. Is it just when to do it, how to do it? You just sprinkle them on, you mow first, you know, what's the best way to give them the best chance to bring in some more native diversity into this tall, a lot of what is tall grass?
Well, it's a great question, and a couple of things. First off, I would highly recommend a book called Sowing Beauty by James Hitchmore. It's a pretty valuable book for imagining plantings from seed. And it has a lot of information, but I'll give you some bullet points. You will always need way more seed than what you think you do. When you're talking about sowing seed directly into a we'll call it a field environment, you know, in an established area. You know, most of that seed, just for a number of physical and biological principles, just is not going to germinate. You know, the field emergence rate of a packet of seed versus the emergence rate of that seed, say, in a greenhouse or in a growing situation in your basement under lights, for example, is just vastly different. And so if you're looking to try and achieve, in a very cost-effective way, successful seeding at some scale, you will need to, you know, really think about kind of the area and the amount of seed that you'll need. Seed suppliers like Prairie Moon Nursery in Winona, Minnesota, Prairie Nursery in Wisconsin, other places, you know, can give you guidance on exactly the rates, and based on, you know, whether you have a quarter an acre or a half an acre, whatever size, or, you know, maybe it's 10,000 square feet or something, whatever. They can give you information on kind of the ideal rates to use like that. Now, let's say you were more interested in maybe growing the seeds you know, yourself, and maybe in a, you know, raising transplants that you would then set out and establish that way. You would, you know, you could get by with far less seed that way. But again, the timing depends on what species you have. And so if you go to, again, a nursery website like Prairie Moon, they have for every species in their catalog a little key on that page that tells you the way in which to germinate many of those native species. Some species germinate, you know, like a lawn seed. You sow it and it comes up and it's not a problem. Others need a period of what we call cold stratification, essentially a winter like period, cool, wet for a period of maybe 30 or 60 days or something. It just depends. You know, and then you can kind of, you know, tackle it from there. For, you know, in our world, we start sowing seed oftentimes in November and then keep sowing seed in our greenhouse and our nursery setting and, you know, up until sometimes even well into the spring, depending on what we're trying to do. But I'm so glad you've bought seed already. Growing plants from seed is so rewarding.
Angela, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas at WPR.org. David in New Richmond, it's your turn. Thanks for calling, David.
Hey, thanks, Larry. I was wondering if your author would know anything about Xeric landscaping. We were just in the Southwest and saw the extreme drought, and still there's people who are irrigating lawns and trying to grow tropical plants outside. And maybe talk about the importance of matching your habitat to your rainfall or lack of rainfall.
That's a spectacular question. You raised such a keystone point for my practice in that, you know, no matter where I'm working, the planting needs to be situated in place. It needs to honor place. It needs to celebrate place. And, you know, that is just so key. You know, in the desert Southwest, there is spectacular plant diversity. Some of the most incredible plant diversity that exists on this continent is native to the desert Southwest. And yet, you just as you know, we see people trying to kind of import these ideas that are not resource conscious, that are frankly expensive and sort of ridiculous to try and do. I mean, we're blessed in so many ways as upper Midwesterners that we, you know, we have 6 inches of good topsoil in most places, and it rains more often when we need it to. And so, you know, that's the nature of our place. We can work within that context. So, you know, that's so important. Whether you're, you know, somebody who lives in a tallgrass prairie biome, or maybe you're, you know, from more, you know, northern parts of Wisconsin, and you have more of a forest biome that's kind of your parent or more recent precedent community. There's great inspiration from starting at least with that as a foundation. Even within what we call prairie, I mean, there's incredible nuances of wet to dry and rich soils to poor soils. So it can sound sort of monolithic, like, oh, you know, I guess I'm stuck on the prairie, but it doesn't mean that at all. In fact, there's ample amounts of plant diversity that we can interpret even within a specific biome into a whole variety of beautiful gardens. So that's a great point and a great question.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Kathy emailed. She's just moved into a new place that has above-ground planting. What can she put in at this time of the year? Also, how do you fertilize? She's got these planters is what she's got. Can planters be a part of this?
Yes, they can. In fact, there's a new book coming out maybe in the next year or so from a colleague of mine that's literally going to address, you know, how you can create little stylized, meadowy kinds of plantings in containers and small kind of spaces, you know, like in condos and apartment buildings where there's kind of these, you know, built-in, impounded areas for plantings and whatnot. So, yes, you absolutely can leverage these sorts of spaces. It's funny, people already plant containers in a kind of wild and kind of jammed together sort of way. I always kind of joke that people use containers as a way to kind of work out their garden fantasies in a small space where they can kind of control them. And so actually we take on a completely opposite approach. Our containers tend to be more specimen plantings that we incorporate into kind of the otherwise wild exuberance of the garden itself. So I just say, keep working that idea. If that's the small space that you have to work with, those kind of dense, exuberant plantings can be quite effective and quite lovely. So, you know, it depends on her question about fertilizing or utilizing plants in containers. Of course, in an artificial environment, it does help to give them a little encouragement, certainly, with water and those sorts of things. We actually have done some experiments with different kinds of media and slow-release fertilizers, which there's a number of products out there. And you can really get it so that you're doing nothing more than just kind of watering, maybe every few days or something. Of course, it's been beastly hot here, so it feels like all we're doing in containers is watering, every other minute. But yes, the long and short of it is you can certainly have wilder, personable, plantings in containers.
And the plants themselves, she was also asking what could she put in at this time of the year. I'm not sure. Probably a Southern Wisconsin caller here. So,
You can, we're still planting. I mean, we were planting this morning. We really, in so many ways, never kind of stop planting through the summer. I mean, when it gets extremely hot, when it's just not, resource conscious to try and, just water something so much, we might pull back on it. But many perennials can still be planted this time of year, so long as you kind of keep them watered to establishment. We're always planting. We kind of never stop.
Kelly Norris, our guest. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. And I have noticed in your book, although there are some nice expanses of land, there are also there's the possibility of putting small corners of a property or smaller spaces in your lawn or along the home or whatever that where you can do this kind of thing.
Absolutely, Larry. I mean, most gardens are small. I mean, we know that just from the census data about how sort of what the median lot size is in the U.S., which is about 0.2 acres, and largely has stayed the same for most of the last 20 years. And so, if you're a median homeowner out there on 0.2 acres and your house takes up some portion of that, it doesn't leave a huge amount of space for gardening left over. And so I always have been very realistic about that most gardens are small. And so, and there was this idea for so long that, you couldn't do these things in small spaces, that you really somehow, you need a big space to be able to pull off these kind of wilder plantings, which is just kind of probably a well-intended piece of advice, but just doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, plants grow where you plant them, and if they're things that are adapted to place or are native to place and have some connection to the ecology around them, you can create those kinds of settings in spaces of almost any size. Certainly, the dynamics are different. There is a scalar difference in exactly, how the plant community of sorts might grow on 100 square feet versus the same community on 1,000 square feet, or 10,000 square feet or more. But you shouldn't feel limited at all. You can actually have quite a lot of fun with these things, take that little piece of the world that you own or have access to, and make a positive contribution.
A couple of emails that relate to sort of specific plants here. So one from Mark near Iola. He has a 10-year-old birch tree that's developed an odd growth from the base, what he would call a sucker or suckers. They've grown about 3 inches tall, and normally he would just cut them off, treating them such as sucker stalks that take away vitality from the main tree. But his wife, who's a master gardener, thinks that may not be a concern, those suckers. The tree appears healthy otherwise.
Yeah, I would agree that it's not really a concern. I mean, birches naturally sucker in the wild. I mean, we sell them as kind of single leaders because I apparently that's more fashionable to the majority of consumers. But, honestly, when we spec birches, if we're in a place where that's appropriate, we always want multi-stems anyway. We want to be able to see a more kind of natural habit. Not all species of birches do that exactly, but a great number of them do. Our river birches and our papers and our grays all do those things. So You know, it's to me just a more natural look, but certainly, you know, there's no, particularly if they're only a few inches tall, there's no great harm that they're doing at all. It's pretty much just how the plant is kind of wired to grow.
Yeah. And Rick emailed, he asks, how can you identify or how could he identify a strawberry plant variety that he's found in his landscape in his garden?
Well, depending on where he's at, there are really only two native species of Fragaria strawberries that are kind of found in the upper Midwest. One is Fragaria virginiana, and the other is Fragaria vesca. And so there's, I'm sure there's some plant ID sites that can kind of sort of show you, illustrate the difference between the two. Virginiana has larger leaves more often than vesca does. Vesca is sometimes called the woodland strawberry, although it kind of occurs in a variety of places. And Virginiana is in the wild, typically found in more open areas, kind of runs through prairies. Both are great, what we would call a matrix plant, a good ground cover for wilder plantings. You don't always see them, but they're doing a lot of work. So they're kind of covering the ground and covering spaces. So there's, if you're in the upper Midwest, there's really only two options as far as what's native, Virginiana or Vesca.
Okay, let's go to Bob in Eau Claire then. Bob, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I've got a wooded area that's got a pretty good slope to it, and I'm seeing soil erosion going on. What can I get for a ground cover in a pretty shady environment?
Well, you know, natively speaking, sedges in the genus Carex, sort of small grass-like plants, would be what would typically be growing there. In fact, I would reason to bet that if you we were to take a little botanical survey out there, there's probably already native species of sedges growing in that woodland understory. And so the nice thing about them is that they're particularly plants like Carex pennsylvanica, the Pennsylvania sedge, which is native across most of the eastern half of the U.S., is a great ground cover. I mean, kind of grows in drier ridges and, you know, upland wooded slopes, and does a great job of holding the soil in place. But that's just one of hundreds that are native to, you know, each of our states here in the upper Midwest. Again, places like Prairie Nursery, Neil DeBall's company up there in Wisconsin sells a great number of them, and has a, you know, very informative website as well, too, that can certainly shed some insights onto maybe what would be the best ones, you know, in your specific location. But the bullet point on sedges is that there's pretty much a sedge for every place you can imagine on the planet. West, understate, there's an option out there, and they're great, great problem solvers for erosion.
Bob, thank you very much. Good luck with that. Appreciate it. Ben in Ottawa, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a couple questions. I'm going to have a follow-up to Bob there from Eau Claire for ground cover, and I'll preface it. I have a business called Sourced in Nature based out of Wisconsin here, but we do a lot of stuff with foraging. What about wild ramps, Allium trichocum, as a ground cover?
Yeah, I mean, ramps do a reasonably good job of, you know, at holding the soil. Typically, you know, we like to we like to think about matrix plants as plants that have, you know, kind of as long of a season of kind of vitality as possible. You know, we want them to be kind of as present as you know, for a long a period of time as possible. Maybe further north where you're at, you know, ramps can be more persistent in foliage throughout the season than they sometimes can be here. But it's a good thought, because certainly they grow in colonies, and, you know, plants, generally speaking, I talk about this in the book, you know, if you can think about the architecture of a plant without even really knowing what it is for a moment, you can think, okay, well, if I want something to hold the ground, I need something that has a colonial habit, that has, you know, foliage that sits fairly close to the ground, you know, extensive root systems in all directions like that. Those are all going to be good candidates as far as just archetypes go for that kind of situation. So I think it certainly would be worth considering.
Yeah.
Sure. Sure. Well, and that leads into my next question, because, you know, ramps, of course, are edible, and they're fantastic edibles. But my next question is, and a few people have brought it up, on more prairie settings, or a lot of people in Wisconsin, whether it's, you know, quote unquote residential or a little bit more rural, we have these farm fields, or maybe farm fields that have been reclaimed to just prairie, but there are strips of trees, right? So what we try to practice is some permaculture, so like a step-down method from that tall canopy of, you know, the little strip of trees between farm fields of oaks and hickories and elms. My question to you is, what are some good plants that will bear, you know, fruit meaning actual fruit or nuts, different types of edible species?
Oop, you're kind of breaking up there. Yeah.
Well, I think I've got the nature of the question, though. I mean, one of my favorite native edible shrubs that fits perfectly in those kinds of hedgerow situations that you're describing is our American hazelnut, Corylus americana. Smaller nuts than more traditionally agronomic hazelnuts, but still quite useful and edible. I think that our native plums, which are often small suckering trees or large shrubs, don't get nearly the kind of attention that they deserve. Prunus americana, our American wild plum, is terrific. As you get closer to the lakes, you can pull in some beech plum, Prunus maritima. So these are great plants for that kind of middle canopy layer. I mean, they're in some ways understory shrubs, but they do appreciate some openness and some space to kind of fill out and sucker and form a copse or a colony. Of course, there's a great number of prairie shrubs that do this, not all of which are maybe edible, to your point, but other things like our native dogwoods, Salix humulus, our native prairie willow. There's a huge number of shrubs that are kind of waiting for their moment in the spotlight still. I mean, they've been a part of our native horticultural trade for some time, but have maybe not been as widely appreciated as they deserve. So I think there's a lot of options for that kind of condition that you're describing, and one that is pretty familiar, as you know, to people with maybe a rural or suburban property.
Yeah. Ben, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Carrie in Janesville, it's your turn. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, hi guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm having a heck of a time with calla lilies. I buy them every year and I can't keep them alive. They wilt down. This last batch I grew started to wilt down. Then they sent off these magnificent pods that dropped all the seeds. And I'm wondering if I collect these seeds or leave the seeds, will I get more calla lilies? How do I do that?
Well, I wouldn't recommend growing calla lilies from seed. I mean, it just is not a very rewarding or fast method for a home gardener to probably raise more. Calla lilies that you buy bare root, some varieties do not have the longest bloom season. They also like a incredible amount of water. They're actually a marginal plant in their wild subtropical and tropical haunts. And so in my former life directing horticulture at a botanic garden, we actually grew ours in submerged pots at the water's edge and would actually keep them fairly happy for a long period of time. So they actually need a lot of water relative to a lot of other summer flowering bulbs that you might buy in the spring. So that would maybe be, probably what I could say about calla lilies.
Yeah. Carrie, thank you so much for calling. Kelly Norris, our guest today. His book is titled New Naturalism, Designing and Planning a Resilient, Ecological, Vibrant Home Garden. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kelly Norris, award-winning author and plantsman. And is the author of the book New Naturalism. And it's fun to have him here as we talk about designing your garden with nature in mind. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take another call. Sullivan in Green Bay, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, yeah, so my question is mostly on plant inbreeding. One, is it possible? And two, how is that controlled?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part of the question. You'll have to repeat it.
Yeah, sorry. Can plants inbreed? And if so, how is that controlled?
Oh, plants absolutely can inbreed. I mean, the whole, you know, principle of how we produce corn is essentially from using inbred lines. And so plants tolerate inbreeding far better than most other organisms for whatever particular reason. So, you know, some plants, it is actually quite common for plants to perpetuate themselves through populations, that is, of a plant to perpetuate itself through inbreeding. It mainly means that individuals are self-fertile. So a single plant has often, you know, can have both male and female flowers or male and female components of in the same flower. And can produce viable seed of themselves. Some species really prefer outcrossing and that they like to exchange gametes with different individuals. So, you know, both circumstances happen pretty abundantly in the plant world. There's not a bias necessarily in one area or another, and there's not really strong biases across, you know, different plant families, monocots or dicots. So sometimes those are can be diagnostic keys, but it's both situations are pretty common in the world of plants. Our world wouldn't be what it is without at least some amount of inbreeding taking place in fairly common plants.
And in terms of avoiding inbreeding, he was wondering about how to avoid inbreeding.
Well, I mean, I guess that's a as simple as actually a question with a fairly complex answer. I think in some cases, yeah, there are certainly instances where plants, you know, where inbreeding depression is a phenomenon that happens in reproductive biology that, you know, can lead to the genetic deconstruction of populations. So, the great sort of like former professor answer in me is that, well, it just really depends. That's a big question.
Oh, man. Sullivan, thank you for calling. Gianni in Montello, your turn. Hi.
Yes. Hey, I believe that Aldo Leopold in Sand County Almanac writes that this species that we know is quackgrass, that is kind of a problem in all over today, at least in Wisconsin, was brought in from Europe in the 19th century. Is this true, and is it an invasive species, and are there any merits to this plant?
Well, that's an interesting question. Yeah, Aldo Leopold, of course, the great revered kind of thought leader far ahead of his day in writing the Sand County Almanac, which has been one of my inspirational tomes throughout my life. Does have some things to say about quackgrass, which is actually botanically a rye. Elymas repens is its botanical name, also called couchgrass in some places. It is a Eurasian species. It is found all over the world now. You know, does it have value? It certainly is a plant that I think a great number of people would rather maybe not be where it so often occurs. I'm certainly making no excuses for it, but I think one of the challenges that we have sometimes is we tend to see the world through these kind of very rigid, strict constructs that may just not actually be the best way of interpreting the kind of complexity of ecology. So I'm not defending quackgrass, but I think you ask a good philosophical question that maybe has just should lead to more questions than maybe an answer. But we spend a lot of time seemingly trying to decide what to keep and what to kill in the botanical world. And, you know, sometimes we can often create more problems than we often solve in so doing. But, you know, certainly if you're trying to keep a reasonably good stand of turf for any kind of recreational activity, quackgrass is not your friend. It can get into plantings, too, certainly of ecological nature, because it is kind of grassy and seems maybe kind of innocuous at first before you realize that it's sort of, you know, running out your ears. So certainly when we're managing plantings, you know, we're obviously wanting to create a strong bias towards the things we've planted or designed and engineered into that circumstance, and being a referee and calling the shots maybe against things like quackgrass. But I'm sure in some places it's holding together soil maybe where it otherwise might be moving away from us. So maybe it has I always think of these things like on a scale, right? It's certainly not on a scale of 1 to 10, and nobody's going to give it a 10 for ecological value, but it's probably doing at least a 1 or a 2.
Yeah. That was the one thing that I was thinking about. It will hold soil.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Johnny, thank you for calling. Gary in Eau Claire, your turn now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes. I've got a couple of Dutch elm trees that I cut down.
Uh-huh.
And on the stumps, there's suckers coming up. And I'm wondering if they're going to be susceptible to the same disease that had killed the trees before.
Hmm.
Yes. I mean, the suckers are just, you know, a last gasp for life, you know, from a tree that it can do that on its own in the wild. So, yes, the short answer is those suckers would be as susceptible to anything that original tree was, because they're just another, you know, growth of that same individual.
Yeah. Have you had success with elms, some of the newer elms, and that are at least resistant to Dutch elm disease?
We have. We were maybe one of the first public gardens at Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden, over 10 years ago, or almost 10 years ago now, that had original plants of St. Croix that were some of the first that had been produced by Bailey Nurseries and others, and found them to be impressive trees, both with respect to disease resistance, their relative rate of growth. Anybody who's ever planted elms knows that while they're stately, wonderful trees, you know, they do require some pruning work in their younger years to kind of keep the canopy headed in the kind of the right direction. We found that we had some pruning to do on the St. Croix, but it seemed, maybe qualitatively speaking, that we had that they were growing in a fairly nice fashion. So it would be something that would be recommended for homeowners, or certainly because of the disease resistance, obviously. But as elms go, they were they gave us less headaches from a pruning standpoint than some elms can be when they're young. So that's been my principal exposure to the disease-resistant selections.
Yeah, and have they proven to be resistant?
So far, so good. 10 years in, and those trees are still very much there and looking pretty good.
Shelley in Reeseville, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Shelley.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
So my mom has got a trumpet vine. And it's a great big one. It's like it's being held up by one of them little arbor things or whatever you call them. Mm-hmm. But all the shoots are coming up through the lawn, through her lawn in her backyard. I mean, just hundreds of them. And, you know, and they can grow really fast. Some of them are, you know, a foot tall. But how do you get rid of all them in the lawn without killing the others?
Yeah, that's the downside to planting trumpet vine or having trumpet creep around, is that it is quite prone to doing that. You can mow them off, and it won't kill the main plant. It also won't kill all of those suckers, but it's about the only good way to kind of control it in that circumstance, because it does, you know, sort of natively of its own constitution want to be quite vigorous and quite roving. We have a patch of it on the edge of our property that is a remnant from something that someone planted many decades ago, I'm sure. I'm sort of resigned to the fact that we'll never really be rid of it. Occasionally it does, a shoot gets away from us and up the tree and flowers, and certainly has some value for hummingbirds and those kinds of things. But it can seed around, does spread vegetatively. It certainly is a plant that has an aggressive profile for keeping in check.
Is it something you ever use yourself?
Never. It's just too, unfortunately, and it was sold, by the way. It's funny, this question came up. I was literally having this discussion with someone yesterday who was in our garden and noted it on the fence and kind of the edge there. And it was actually sold fairly commonly. I mean, I think you can still buy it. I think there's some nurseries probably still carry it. But in the 50s and the 60s, it was quite common because, it flowers in the summer. And there's just in the upper Midwest, not a huge long list of shrubs and trees that do that. And so people are always kind of looking for, you know, I want a tree that flowers in summer. And so it's not a tree, of course, but it can be trained to be upright and kind of be a big, you know, kind of vine, shrub-like vine almost. And so it was very popular, I think, in a certain period of time. And it continues to be popular. Well, it continues to be persistent, whether it's still popular or not. Those plants are probably all still around. But it's just so aggressive, it's just hard to keep in check, particularly in a smaller garden. So we typically don't use it.
And Shelley, in the case of her mother's trumpet vine, can you get rid of the main vine and just be done with the whole thing?
Well, you could. As we were describing to this person with a similar question last night, you can, if you kill the main one, the suckers can live independently of themselves. So they have a canny way of kind of sticking around despite whatever amount of disturbance that are there. So I would say if it's the suckers are a problem in the lawn, just keep them mowed back with the rest of the lawn, and that's probably about the best solution.
Okay. Kelly Norris, an award-winning author and plantsman and the former director of horticulture and education at the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden in Iowa. His book is titled New Naturalism, Designing and Planting a Resilient, Ecologically Vibrant Home Garden. Our guest on Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about creating landscapes that are based on how nature creates them. And our guest is Kelly Norris. Kelly is an award-winning author and plantsman and the former director of horticulture and education at the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden in Iowa. So as we talk with Kelly, I hope you'll join in. What interests you in gardening based on nature? What other gardening questions do you have? Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Kelly, over our news break, I had an email came in from Megan. She gardened for 41 years on sand in central Wisconsin and cursed quackgrass for too many of those years. It was a constant plague. But one day it occurred to her that if not for quackgrass, she would not have had a lawn, and the huge hill deposited behind her by the glaciers would have eroded away if not for the complex rhizomes of this grass that held the soil.
You know, the world is invariably more complicated than we most often recognize. And so I think that is a wise observation to have made after a long time spent gardening in the same place. I happen to love gardening on sand. I actually recreated a sand so sort of what might have been on this hill at one point before all of the glacial sediment eroded and revealed only the hardpan clay. So we actually have a fairly expansive sand garden, I guess you could say, in our backyard. Sand is a wonderful, wonderful medium to grow in. And in the wild hosts a whole lot of plants unique to it. And so I think that's a great point to open up with, that sometimes we're better students when we just listen and observe than trying to solve things that may not be so easily solved.
Let's take a call from Andy in Green Bay. Andy, hello. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Thank you for taking my call. I live in the country, and there's a small woodlot next to my property. It's all full of elms that keep dying, box elder, and cottonwoods that keep making a mess. I just had to cut down a dead box elder in my yard, and I want to replace it with something. What would you recommend other than box elder or elm or cottonwood?
Well, I it sounds like if those are the kind of dominant trees that are present there, there's been some history of disturbance. Tell me a little bit about, maybe what is it? Sandy soil? Are you on a flood plain? Like, tell me a little bit about where you're at.
Just northeast of Green Bay, up on the Niagara Escarpment. It's pretty basic soil.
It's not sandy there.
Yeah. Okay. I'm trying to think of things that might be in that sort of habitat naturally. You could think of, American beech probably is in your part of the world. White oaks would probably be, trees that would be in those kind of forest environments. Red oaks probably as well, too, if you're thinking about something that might be a better shade tree, something with a more statelier presence than the trees you've just described. Those would be maybe three choices that come to mind, as a shade tree goes for that kind of place.
Yeah, those could work for sure. Andy, good luck. Thank you. Rob in Appleton, on to you now. Hi, Rob.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been thinking about this for a couple of years now, and I've never found the answer. But we were driving in maybe western Wisconsin two summers ago, and it was probably like late July or August, and we noticed these lilac trees that were fully bloomed. And I thought, is that the same kind of lilacs that we have, and they just happen to bloom a second time? Or because we have lilacs in our yard that just bloom in the spring, and then they're gone. And I'm wondering if you could maybe shed a little light on that.
Well, so there is a phenomenon that plants, and I noticed this last fall, too, driving in Minnesota in September, that there were lilacs flowering. And so it's a phenomenon sometimes called precocious flowering, and it happens in species that typically flower in the spring that can be cued to flower in the fall, usually by stress. And so last year, it was through certain parts of the upper Midwest, was a pretty dry year. And so it was a phenomenon that I think a lot of people observed on lilacs last year, where they weren't flowering maybe to the same degree that they would have in the spring, but it was certainly odd to observe them in the fall. Sometimes it can be a predictor of ultimate decline in the plant. Sometimes it happens somewhat errantly in response to the stress, and then the next year things seem to be fine. So it's kind of a, like I said, more of a phenomenon than it is anything else. But it does tend to happen in plants that flower in the spring and can be cued by a combination of stress and cooler nights and those things to flower again in the fall, which is not dissimilar from conditions than they would typically flower under in the spring. It's just that they've not had a winter in between.
Yeah, that we had a lot of that in Wisconsin, and that was exactly what folks were saying. Your description of what causes it was pretty spot on with what other people have said on Garden Talk programs in the past year or so. A lot of people were wondering about it. Rob, thank you. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Sarah in Lake Geneva. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. My question, we're very shady. We have a hill in the backyard that no matter what kind of grass we planted, it lasts for a little while, and then it washes away when we get big rains. And I'm wondering what else we might be able to plant there so that it was still a little bit navigable, but would be, shored up and not just wash away.
And what kind of soil do you have there?
Mostly it's clay.
Okay.
So is this you're talking about species of turf grass that you've attempted to plant to grow a lawn?
Yes, and I'm thinking maybe we go with something else that's not a grass. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, I think you could look maybe for some other native shorter grasses that would just have a more extensive root system that would allow those plants to maybe hold the soil a little bit better than, you know, a turf grass. I mean, the downside about most turf grasses is, of course, they don't have extensive root systems. I apologize. Tell me again where exactly you're at.
Just north of Lake Geneva.
So southern Wisconsin.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm thinking about something like Sidoates grama, which is one of our native prairie short grasses. It's native in Illinois and Wisconsin, Iowa, and further west and south too. But you know, they have kind of a fountain-like habit. They're not a tall grass. They might be 18 to 24 inches tall. They grow very well on clay. We have heavy clay here at Three Oaks at home, and we use Sidoates grama, Botulua curtipendula is the botanical name in our meadow, because it does gets good fall color. It stays kind of, you know, lower than the taller grasses, and it does an incredible job of mitigating erosion. So you know, you could still maybe keep a path through it or something, or it is a grass that has evolved to grazing, so you can kind of give it a haircut of sorts in midsummer, although it's kind of at its peak in midsummer and looks really nice, so maybe you'd choose to just leave it alone. But it might be an option for that circumstance.
Sidoates grama. There you go, Sarah. I hope that helps. Thank you so much. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Ken in Colfax. Hi, Ken.
Hey, Larry. I've listened to your show a long time, and every once in a while I think I should call, but don't. This time I'm going to. I heard the earlier call. I might have missed some of it in all the tractor about crack grass, and, you know, I think it's very underappreciated. It's makes pretty nice hay. Like right now, we're just finished up making hay, and we made some really nice hay that's going to be very palatable. It's good for horses, beef cattle, even dairy cattle. And it does kind of take over, but it's not like weed canary grass or something like that. And I wonder if some of your callers and commenters, any grass becomes quack grass if it isn't Timothy. And well, there are differences.
that could be true. I mean, you make a good point that, you know, we're, you know, I'm a grass geek. I love grasses and study them and grown a lot of them and collected them. And you know, it helps sometimes to always remember that there are a lot of different grasses in the world. So you're right that probably a lot of grasses of lesser value get labeled quack grass as almost maybe a misnomer or somewhat discursively. But, you know, I think you make a very rational point in the sense that, as Aldo Leopold, I believe, observed in the Sand County Almanac, it's been here for a long time, and it's not going away. So you don't have to like it, but it is part of our kind of hybrid, disturbed ecological fabric that kind of follows the human contrails. And so it's interesting. I didn't know it was a good palatable grass for hay, so that's interesting. That's a new insight for me.
Ken, thank you. Appreciate the call. Oh, boy. Carrie in Cronenwetter. Your turn. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Larry. Hey, in regard to the lilac that a gentleman saw blooming during the summer, there is a variety called Bloomerang, and that shrub will bloom in the spring, go die off, and then rebloom again during the summer and, I guess, up to frost. I just purchased some recently, and I'm anxious to see them bloom during the summer.
Ah.
Yes, there you're totally right. There are a number of now reblooming cultivars of lilac. These tend to be interspecific hybrids that are often quite a bit smaller than traditional lilacs, which is nice for home gardens, and they tend to perform fairly well. I mean, they rebloom fairly consistently. There's a number of them now out there. Bloomerang has been one that's, I think, kind of become a staple of that category, and so you're totally right. That's a good point to make.
Yeah, thank you, Carrie. Appreciate it. Bloomerang. That's a type that hasn't come up on the show, or at least I can't remember it coming up on the show before. Brian in Lake Geneva, your turn now. Hi, Brian.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been watching a small oak tree grow next to my cherry tree. It's now 4 foot tall. and it's coming, it's right butted up against the cherry tree, which is about 30 foot tall. Is there a way of extracting that out of there, replanting it without killing it?
Do you know what kind of oak it is? Is it a red oak, or what do the leaves look like, if you don't know for sure?
I'm going to go with the red.
It's a pointed leaf?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, if it's that close to an established cherry, practically speaking, probably not. Is there a way? Yes. The challenge with oaks is that they are taprooted species. And so if I heard you right, that you said it was 4 feet tall, the taproot on that oak is going to be fairly significant at this point. And of course, in the nursery industry, we move oaks like that all the time, but they're in field situations that, where you can get a tree spade around it and you can get as much of that taproot as possible, or you can, root prune it in such a way that you get some finer root growth. That would be difficult to do under the canopy of an existing cherry tree. So you might be faced with a decision here at some point.
Yeah. And the other problem is with the taproot, then you also could be damaging, or you would damage, the roots of the cherry.
Right, right.
So I don't know. I don't think I'd try. Well, you could always try it, I guess. But don't expect great results, Brian.
You're going to have to become the arbiter and the judge here. So.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Bill in Bayfield, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. My wife and I want to start a natural garden. It'll be about 100 feet by 100 feet, so it's not huge but not insignificant. And I want to explore the options of seeds versus plugs versus plants from garden centers. The plants from garden centers could get pretty expensive, but I've heard you talk earlier on the show about seeds. So I was hoping you could talk more about plugs. Some of the catalogs I'm looking at offer plugs. Are those seeds that have been germinated in, let's say, a greenhouse over the winter, or are they one-year-old plants? And how long can we expect it to take before they bloom?
Great question. We work probably 75% of my practice is utilizing landscape plugs for plantings. The short answer to your question is yes. A plug is essentially a plant, a seed that was sown perhaps the fall prior, sometimes maybe just the spring prior to planting if it's the current season, really depends on the species, that has an extensive root system that can support what seems to be a fairly small plant, but actually is as a ratio goes, is a better root to shoot ratio than sometimes a much bigger plant can be at a garden center, particularly for many perennials. And so, and that is a far more cost effective way of doing it. And so, a plug, per unit might be a third of the cost or less compared to the same plant in a 1 gallon sized pot or larger. For an area that you're talking about 10,000 square feet, just to help you do the math, I mean, at an average 12 inches on center spacing, which is the minimum density, we wouldn't space it out too much farther across the model than that. That's 10,000 plants. It's a lot of plants to create that space. Certainly, seed is the much more cost-effective way of doing it. I mean, you could probably seed that whole area for a few $100 in seeds, but the challenge, of course, then becomes managing, weeds in the first couple of seasons. If it's a highly visible area, it's going to take a few years before it's going to look like something. And so, there are kind of trade-offs, pros and cons with each approach, certainly. And we weigh those, of course, with every project and every commission that comes into the studio, because it's part of the practical nature of how we make our art and do our work. But so there's not I wouldn't say there's a right or wrong answer. It kind of just depends on the circumstances and the budget and what you want to try to achieve. But 10,000 square feet is getting up there in terms of planting size. I mean, for comparison, I mean, we did a commission a couple weeks back that was a half an acre planting with 25,000 plants on a big public project. So we certainly can do plantings at that scale. It becomes a titanic effort. And at some point, everybody has a budget. So yeah. There's a limit to, you know, what you can do and where and when. I certainly get that. But plugs, are, back, you know, to the core of the question, you know, if you're looking for a cost-effective way to be able to do a planting versus a seeding at some scale, plugs are the way to go. And there are increasingly more of those available to home gardeners. Because I think the industry realizes that it's a, you know, it's a smart way to get a lot of plants into people's hands.
Yeah, yeah. There you go, Bill. Thank you for calling. Bob in Bear Lake or Bear Creek, excuse me. What's on your mind, Bob?
Well, we a decade or more ago we had success with a red bud in a very warm microclimate next to our house, and now recently. Well, that tree's gone, but recently we've tried to replant them in some other places, and they seem to be dead in the spring, but then come up from the roots. And then additionally, last year we did a mulberry tree. It grew tremendously, really tall, taller than a corn stalk. We were advised to prune it, but it too is, the stalk is dead and it's coming from the ground. Does that mean we're in too far north of range for those two species?
Well, maybe. I mean, you know, there are, I know there are redbuds of northern provenances in Wisconsin and Minnesota that are in the trade. There's a selection from University of Minnesota called Heart's Desire that has been proven hardy, you know, in the UMN system for a number of years now. But, you know, that is, you know, what you're seeing there is a plant that is clearly root hardy. It's wanting to, it's able to regenerate from its root mass, but it is not proving to be reliably stem hardy. So red buds can even do that here. I mean, we're a, you know, fair bit warmer than you are, but not by much, but even here, red buds can be prone to do that in some particularly cold years. So, you know, and you can grow red buds as a multi-stem tree regrown from, you know, kind of crown suckers like that, and they can end up being quite lovely. But you may end up playing this cycle out over many years where, you know, you'll be able to grow them for a few years and then those stems will die off. And so my recommendation would be to maybe seek out varieties or a nursery that's collected seed from those more northern places and produce trees that may have just a better shot at being hardy.
Yeah, there you go, Bob. Thank you so much. Kelly, I wanted to ask you how has your book been received? How's it sold and so forth?
Well, we have just been kind of blown away by it. I mean, it came out last year. Folks can really buy it wherever books are sold. It's online. You can buy autographed copies from me online at kellydnorris.com. But it's into its fourth printing now, which is, I've never had a book. This is my fourth book, I think. We've never had a book go into that many printings, so it's really gratifying that people have kind of latched on to these ideas. There's certainly more to say. It's the beginning of a conversation, a beginning of a journey, but there are other good books out there as well, too, and I think there's increasingly more information and even opportunities like this, which I greatly appreciate, to talk with people and answer their questions. So we've been very pleased with the reception.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book and with great photography and really good writing. And I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today, Kelly. Thank you so much.
Larry, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Kelly Norris, our guest, award-winning author and plantsman, and his book is called New Naturalism. That's the title. The subtitle is Designing and Planting a Resilient, Ecologically Vibrant Home Garden. Pleasure to have him on. We'll probably get him back at some point and do this again with him. Just a look ahead to Monday, Bassam Shakashiri is back, and he'll talk about science, a bunch of issues relating to science these days. So we'll deal with him, and then we'll check in with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, and they've got lots to talk about as well. That's Monday, starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. But in the meantime, there's lots more in store right through the afternoon here, and I hope you'll stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network.